Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us. My guest this week, speaking to us from his office, is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton, and we'd love to have your questions for him in our next half an hour. Call those in to 765-496-1999. Send an email to ask@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good to talk to you. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's good to be here.
I want to start out by talking about your annual State of the City address, which you gave earlier this week. I got to ask, did you have any trouble being invited and then uninvited like some other politicians seem to be having?
No, I think we had it right here. I think everything was on track, and it was a nice turnout, and a lot of people listened in, so it went very well for us.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the specifics. You mentioned the city's community paramedic program, how you're trying to bring down healthcare costs. And I wanted to ask you about an official that I'm trying to ask other officials about, which is there anything that your city can do to stop what seems like fairly obvious price gouging by insurance companies in recent years? There's even a national commission that's now exploring this issue. But man, it seems like that's the biggest driver of healthcare costs going up, not the opioid crisis, not aging baby boomers, not failure of cities to do more to try to keep costs down, but it's the insurance companies driving those costs up. Do you see it that way, and are you trying to fight that?
Well, I don't know that we're trying to fight that. We're a very, very tiny piece of that enormous picture. But I will say that having touched on the healthcare industry for my entire career and been involved in the periphery somewhat, and then now seeing it from this perspective. My assessment, and I'm one of these people who kind of boils things down to the basics, but my assessment of the whole situation with the healthcare system is it's just literally uncontrolled, unbridled greed on many levels. And I don't think you can pin it all on insurance companies. I think there are other players in this that can share the blame. When you look at some of the giant healthcare corporations and hospital corporations and so on, pharmacy companies, you just go down the list and it is literally just nothing more than greed. And if it's not checked and not controlled, it spirals out of control. And I think that's what's happened in this case. And by no means is it the healthcare worker or the providers out there trying to do a good job. Their hands are tied by what's going on well above them in the system. So what we're trying to do there is, it's going to take, a lot of innovation and some people really coming to the table to prove new concepts. And what we're trying to do is prove one of those concepts and prove that it works and it can effectively lower healthcare costs. And in our case, the data is pretty overwhelming that it can significantly lower healthcare costs. But, back to the original point, what you discover as part of that process is, yes, this looks like a no-brainer, and yes, the data is solid. But at some point, you run into those who really don't want the system to change because it's very lucrative, to them or to their entity.
On to other things, you touted the number of events that the Fusion 54 building is now hosting each month. You said it's about 60, is that right? An average of about two
correct.
A day?
Yeah, that is correct. And that includes, meetings, various groups, and larger events and smaller events. So that building is very well utilized. And I was in there last week for a couple of different meetings, and each one of those meetings was really geared towards innovation and trying to think differently and come up with new ideas, and they had new players at the table. And I thought, this is exactly what we were after here. This is exactly the point of this facility, and I think it's working very well. Now, it's not at its full potential yet, and we know that. We're kind of easing into it a little bit, and we will be making some staffing changes. I have some retirements coming up here in a few months. The director of operations plans to retire, and we'll be hiring somebody to really take point on that building and program it even more solidly to make sure we're really going after the things we want. So off to a very good start, though.
It seems like you need this space to be an incubator of sorts. If you look a year, 2 years, 5 years in the future, pick a goal for me. Tell me something tangible that you think needs to come out of all of these meetings at Fusion 54.
Well, I think we need to start growing existing smaller businesses, take them to the next level, or encourage new startups to come into our community. And that's the point of marrying all these things together, because, you know, a lot of places have co-working, and that's great. But to have the traditional economic development people in the same building working side by side with them is rather unique. And, you know, put Wabash there, and, you know, the young men who graduate who have unlimited ideas, you know, if you can match some of that up with these other pieces, it really starts to take off. So, you know, my goal is that we see some businesses nurtured and start to grow out of that environment. I think we're already starting to carve out a niche there, and that is, you know, bringing in, you know, people with very innovative ideas to kind of share those ideas and focus how they can really work together to maybe take those ideas into and turn them into reality. And those were the meetings I was in the other day, and I'm very pleased that we are at this stage, you know, having that discussion and really talking about some things happening. You know, everything's not going to succeed, but certainly if some of them do, then it's been a success.
But is there a physical thing that you want to come out of it, whether it's a specific type of business that you either don't have or you don't have enough of? This is something that Emily Seiberg was talking about last week on this program with Chris McBarnes, talking about the fact that the last dry cleaner in Frankfurt has now closed. And we got to thinking about what are some of the amenities that a town of your size and Frankfurt size, because you're about similar in terms of population, what do you have? What don't you have but need? Is there something that you need Fusion 54 to generate for your city that you feel is a weakness, a hole in the city?
Well, we certainly have some weak spots and some areas that we need to shore up. And this facility is not designed to certainly address all of those. You know, I mean, some of those more technical areas we need to shore up. You know, we're not producing electricians and plumbers and welders at the things at the levels we need to produce. So that's part of it. That's not really what this building is designed to do. It's designed to nurture the types of businesses that will start to employ people. And I think we're shooting at a target that's maybe a little different than what some other communities are doing. And we're trying to focus on, information technology and some of those things that, you know, on the surface might seem out of reach for a community our size, but I think on a smaller scale, they're well within reach. And it makes sense for some of those things to develop in a community like ours, where we're surrounded by different pockets of, you know, you have Wabash College here, you have Purdue up the road, you know, IU not that far away, we're close to Indianapolis, I mean, you know, not that far from Chicago. So there is a lot of activity swirling around this area if we figure out how to capture it. And like I said, we're in some talks now that I think could yield some very unique prospects for a community our size that are really focused on the information technology side and where we go with some of that.
Elsewhere in your speech, you talked about the city's police cars getting GPS monitors later this year. Why are you adding those specifically?
Well, that's something we've looked at for a while. You know, it's very helpful if our dispatchers can see exactly where those cars are at, so they can send the closest, you know, officer when there's something going on. You know, sometimes our officers get pulled into situations where they are outside the city, and, you know, let's say there is a pursuit, they're not constantly having to, you know, radio in where they're at, where they're turning, where they're going. I mean, it's just automatically known at that point. So, you know, the same thing applies with fire apparatus and ambulances and so on. They know, you know, that ambulance is, you know, a mile away, and they can send the closest people, and they know when they will be there. So
does this mean the days of the all points bulletin are going the way of the dodo?
Well, I think so. You know, and then part of it too is just for our own, you know, benefit or our community's benefit, it just keeps the accountability there. The technology is in place. Why would we not want to have the accountability in place? And I know our sheriff's department here has had these devices in their vehicles for some time. I'm not sure how long, but quite a while. And you know, if there's an accident involving a responding police car, there's no question we can pull the data and we know how fast they were going. We know exactly what was happening. You know, it just gives another layer of protection to the public and to the public safety professionals that the facts are there, the data's on the table. So it's very, very helpful.
Let me ask you a little bit about that, because you also noted that you've got body cameras, which your officers have had for a while now. That came to prominence, of course, when you released body camera footage to the media of an officer discharging a gun at an actor who the officer didn't know was an actor who was playing a robber, and there was also all sorts of miscommunication about that. But you released the video so people could see what happened there. Now you're adding these GPS units. You talked about wanting to have the facts out there, wanting to get the information. Is this part of a premium being placed, maybe even by public pressure in some ways, on the need for cities to more closely monitor their public servants?
Well, I'm not sure that we're really getting, you know, direct pressure on that. I just think, you know, today when something happens, people want good, accurate information. And we need to be able to provide that. And, you know, with social media and everything in place, people want instant answers, and that's not going to happen. But at least we can, in a timely fashion, you know, gather information and share that, you know, when the legal system allows us, but share that in a way that kind of puts all the cards on the table. And what we saw in the shooting situation here in the city of Crawfordsville was that, you know, once we were able to put that out and show people, they saw it with their own eyes. And I'm not sure we ever would have really been able to, you know, do that without having the video. I mean, it would always been, you know, well, what really happened? And, you know, it's this person's version versus that person's version. And, you know, early on, there were different versions of that story. And when the video came out, there it was. You know, people could see it for themselves. And in my mind, what we invested in those body cameras paid for themselves right then and there with that one incident. So it's well worth it. And the officers will tell you it's for their protection as well. I mean, it's everything is right there, you know, as best can be. You're not going to capture every aspect of a situation, but what you can is right there for everything to be evaluated.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Call in your questions at 765-496-1999. Send an email to ask@wbaa.org. Tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. You also said, and I'm going to quote you now back to you, it's time for us to quit kicking the can down the road and start to fix things. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was pointing out that was really our philosophy from day one, and that's what we've done from day one. There were countless things in this community that literally had just been kicked down the road. You know, let's just get through my term and let the next people worry about it, or that's too problematic, I'm not going to deal with it, or the most common thing was that's too expensive, we're just not going to deal with it. And so, you know, my theory from day one was stop kicking these things down the road and let's roll up our sleeves and bite the bullet in some cases and fix it and be done with it. And, you know, examples of that was, you know, the Axel Plus situation, our sewer plant situation, our combined sewer overflow in the downtown is the classic example. I mean, we were already nearing 20 years past the deadline to fix that. So, you know, there were a lot of different things that just had not been addressed, and my point was that's been our theory all along. Stop kicking it down the road, get to work and fix it. And I think we're kind of getting to the point that we're through that now. We've fixed most of those big issues. Now we can concentrate on kind of going to the next level. And I talked a lot about innovation in that speech because our community is kind of coming full cycle, and we're really becoming one of those communities back to our roots that innovates and leads and coming up with new, more efficient ways to do things.
So this is a message that both you and Chris McBarnes have been taking to your cities. In Frankfort, Mayor McBarnes has gotten a fair amount of pushback. He describes it. Are you feeling any similar consternation there from people? Because let's face it, every time you say, let's stop kicking the can down the road, what you're doing is saying the people before me didn't do their jobs as well as they might have done them. And you've got some people who have been in elected office a little while there. And how do you get people to not just get on board with that, but embody it and admit to the idea of maybe we slacked off in places where we shouldn't have?
Well, I'm pretty careful not to, you know, I don't point fingers backwards, and I don't say, you know, this former mayor didn't do this or that former mayor didn't do that. I, I try to avoid that because it's really, it's irrelevant at this point. But I'm not going to sugarcoat it and say, you know, this is a new problem that just sprung up, you know, in the last year or two, because it's not, and it has to be fixed. So I don't think we, you know, on the city side, we don't have anybody serving in elected office who's really been in position that long. I mean, the furthest going back, you know, I mean, city council-wise, some of them came in the same time I did. Clerk treasurer was one term before me, so it's not like you have far-reaching, you know, people who've been serving for a long time that I've kind of been on both sides of this. So I don't spend time pointing fingers backwards, and I said that the day I was sworn in, January 1st, 2012. You know, if we're looking over our shoulder and we're talking about what happened the last year, 2 years, 4 years, whatever, we're going to crash, and we're not going to do that. And so we've been focused on, this is the situation today. Yes, it's an existing problem that's been here for a while. And my reason for pointing that out is, you know, we've got to get to work and fix this stuff. We can't keep making excuses with things like combined sewer overflow. It's time to make it happen. And people have understood that. I've not received pushback on that, because when you lay it out and explain it, people understand, you know, we have to invest in our future and take care of some of these things.
Well, so it's interesting that you say that, because I think there are some people who might think about it somewhat differently. Both you and Mayor McBarnes have told us on this program that you've had some discussions with your city council where your financial philosophies were a little bit different. You told me a long time ago that you were not necessarily seeing eye to eye with your city council about how much of a rainy day fund to keep, for instance. Mayor McBarnes says, in fact, put out this Facebook video a week or a week and a half ago claiming that people were just pillorying him on social media about his spending and the way that he's dealing with money in his city. And, you know, you've got a couple of fiscally conservative communities historically. You and Mayor McBarnes both kind of doing things a little bit differently. It seems like there's a different calculus there. There's a different navigational path that each of you is having to take to get the entrenched ideas of the community to come around to your thinking, no?
I think it's safe to say, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, these are very conservative communities, and we see this reaching, I see it reaching far more than, you know, just local government. There's been a mindset, you know, very conservative. We're always saving for that rainy day, which I agree with. You know, you need strong reserves, but you also reach a point that you're not taking care of things today and your community's dying, and that's where we were at. You know, early on, in my early years, there was a lot of that back and forth with the city council, and we really seem to be through that now. We don't really have that differing philosophy. I think we're pretty much on the same page. I'm not going to say we always agree 100% on it, but we're pretty close because we've laid out the fact that we are able to do this and make these things happen and still maintain our reserves. And that was one of the points in my speech the other night. You know, when you look at it in totality, we've invested more than $25 million in our infrastructure over the last 4 years. At the same time, our tax rate has fallen. So our tax rate is less this year than it was last year for the city's portion. Our reserves are as strong as they've ever been. They are far stronger than they were, you know, just a few years ago. And our assessed value, which is private investment, has been climbing by $20 to $24 million a year. So you put all that together, and it really starts to make sense. You have to invest to make things happen, and people are starting to see that. And we've, like I said, it's not just local government that fights that. We see it in our nonprofits, and we've worked through some of that because, you know, they're starving, not able to carry out their mission, and then you look and they're sitting on hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank, and you kind of have to scratch your head and ask yourself what their rainy day might be, you know? So I'm proud of our reserves. I think we are the envy of many cities, but, you know, you have to draw a line somewhere and make things happen and get to work.
One more question about the state of the city relating back to not kicking things down the road. There are still a couple of Stellar Communities projects that need to be completed. Perhaps most notable is the Ben-Hur building, which we've talked about on this show a few times. Is that getting done in 2019, or is it still a longer-term view than that? Because obviously, as people may remember, you've had a thought about what was going to happen, and then it turned out that wasn't going to happen, and you've had to go and find other people to do the work, and so you've been sort of playing catch-up on this all along.
Right. Well, I don't think that project will be complete in 2019. I do think it will start in 2019. And here's the thing to keep in mind, and I pointed this out the other night. We call the Ben-Hur Building a stellar project because it was part of our overall proposal. It did not receive 1 cent of funding in the stellar award. So, you know, it's lumped in there, but there was no funding to do anything. So we have to go a different route to make that happen. I'm very confident in the developer who has that property now, and I'm very confident in the plans we're developing to move it forward. And we're going to have some things to say about that probably in the next 2 months. We'll be coming forward and saying, okay, here's the deal, and laying it out. I just want to make absolute certain that we have all of our T's crossed and I's dotted before we do that. But if I had to lay odds on it right now, it will start construction in 2019.
All right. Well, I look forward to being at that press conference telling us what's going to happen.
Yep.
We have talked a few times on this program about the Wabash Heartland Innovation Network, or WIN as it's known. They've now announced a pool of $10 million in grant funding, which is the first, they say, of five sort of rounds of grant funding, which is for, and I'm going to quote them now, projects that improve the region's vitality, education, and connectivity. You have expressed your doubts about whether Crawfordsville is positioned well in the way that WIN has been conceived to get benefit from the overall framework. Do you think Crawfordsville is going to submit anything to try to get some of this money?
Well, I don't know if any group within Crawfordsville is going to. If they are, I'm not aware of it. The city of Crawfordsville is not, but I'm not sure I can answer that nobody else is out there. And you know, I'm the first to say that, yes, I've been very critical of this, and I think somebody has to ask the tough questions. And I'm still asking those questions, and I still don't have answers to those questions. And I'm going to continue asking those tough questions. So, you know, I will say that, you know, there was the most recent presentation I attended, and believe me, I've been to many, was the best one I've been to yet, held the most promise, but it's still not there. And I was told at that meeting that they would get me the information, the answers that I was seeking, they already have those, and they would get those to me, and I still haven't received them. So there's another information session next week. I'm not sure. I've got some conflicts I need to work out in the schedule, so I'm not sure if I'll be there or I'll send someone. But we're still kind of waiting. And, you know, when they rolled out this initial process for people, you know, applying for grants, we gave them a lot of feedback on how we saw that and where we saw the strengths and the weaknesses in that. I haven't seen this actual latest release, you know, spelling out exactly how it's going to take place. So I'm not sure.
This is supposed to be a group that's all about regional cooperation, getting this 10-county region to kind of work together on this Internet of Things research. Do you think that a project incorporating more than one area, if your city were to partner with, or some entity within your city were to partner with a sister group in Frankfort or in West Lafayette, do you think that just looking at how the grant is kind of laid out, the general idea of getting money back from a grant like this, would a partnership like that give such a proposal a better chance of bringing money back to your city in some way?
Well, any collaboration obviously is going to make it more appealing. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I'm just not sure I've seen a realistic approach, in, you know, how you could pull communities together, how you could work through this. It just doesn't seem to fit with the overarching stated goal, which is to improve regional prosperity, and it doesn't seem to fit with the world economy that exists today. Crawfordsville is not an isolated economy. Frankfort's not an isolated economy, and neither is the greater Lafayette area. And I don't think they're thinking in those terms, and it really changes how you approach this, at least as I see it. So, you know, I'm optimistic. I've said that all along, and hopefully continuing to refine. Hopefully they get there. But at the end of the day, I still want to know, you know, if the overarching goal is to improve regional prosperity, how do you measure success? How do we know we're succeeding at doing that? What are the benchmarks you're trying to change? What needles are you trying to move? And that's what I want to see.
Your city's Human Rights Commission, to move to another topic, sent an open letter recently talking about its first 2 years since you reconstituted that group, and I wanted to mention a couple of points in that letter. They point out that ordinances in the city had no protections for sexual orientation or gender identity, which the city council has subsequently adopted. This, of course, is a debate the state is having, even as we speak, about a proposed hate crimes bill at the state level. Do you think that discussion at the State House right now could be informed at all by what happened in your city?
Well, I think it could be. I don't think it will be. I'll get on my soapbox about the legislature. I don't think they're really paying attention to what's happening in any of the cities out there in the state of Indiana, except maybe one or two. So it could be of great benefit to them. I don't think they're going to listen, no.
So were there significant numbers of people, or maybe even small, loud groups of people who were opposed to that change in Crawfordsville, as seems to be the case at the State House?
No. In fact, it passed each reading. I think the first reading there was one person who spoke, maybe two. Second, third readings, I don't think there was any public comment at all. And I think the key was the way our wording is structured, it provides equal protection under the law. And everybody agrees on that. I mean, equal protection under the law. We want to be an open, welcoming community, and we need to do that. I think the distinction is it did not provide greater protection under the law, and that's where you run into the controversy and people having sharp opinions. It didn't single out that this, segment of the population has special protections. It said we're going to protect all these classes and everyone equally. And it just didn't generate a whole lot of discussion in our community because it makes sense to people.
The letter also mentions three instances where the group has acted as an arbiter in cases where people might believe their rights have been abridged in some way. Can you tell us about any of those, one of which the letter says is still ongoing?
Well, there have been cases that, we've tried to create a conduit that people feel, they can reach out if they have a concern, and we've tried to create that, and I think it's working. And we've really tried to just be supportive of the commission. We've provided them legal support so they understand, the lay of the land, really what their role is and isn't, and when they need to make referrals to other, government agencies or whatever. So I think they've done a nice job of that. We knew that it would take some time for them to get their feet under them and kind of get used to their role, and it has, and that's okay. But most of the time what you find is there's a lot of miscommunication, and this group has been able to step in and help facilitate that conversation and improve the communication, and that has really resolved our situations.
Is this a way of keeping people from going to court in some cases?
Well, I suppose possibly. Some things, they talk and they communicate and things are resolved and there isn't a need for a case. I'm not going to say it always will happen. I'm not sure that that's really reality, but it has gone a long way, yes.
All right, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. We appreciate it. We'll do it again next month.
Okay, thank you.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember to tune in 2 weeks' time. We've got a fifth Thursday next month, so 2 weeks from today, we'll talk with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. Send your questions anytime to our email address. That's ask@wbaa.org. And find all of these shows archived at our website. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.